Let's get on with a few more applications of detection of events. We saw a couple of basic approaches based upon the derivative. The first derivative was smoothed approximations to the first derivative to detect the QRS complex in the ECG. And of course, if you detect successive QRS complexes, you can get the heart rate. Now, there is another application that is based upon the derivative operation, but then it's not the first derivative, but the second derivative. And this is the problem of detection of the dichrotic notch that we were interested in. And the problem that we were interested in was to detect the dichrotic notch not for the analysis of the carotid pulse itself, but to identify the second heart sound S2 in the phonocardiogram. So the problem here is a method to detect the dichrotic notch in the carotid pulse. And this problem was addressed by my first graduate student, master's student in Canada, Rick Lehner, who worked with me, 25 years ago. And he developed a technique, and we addressed the issue by looking at the fact that the dichrotic notch appears as a short incisura or an inflection on the downward slope of the carotid pulse. Now, if you just take the first derivative, you'll be detecting the slope, but that's not what we want. We want to get the discontinuity on the slope. So for that, we said, let us use the second derivative. There are a few different definitions of the second derivative. You can take the first derivative, yn is equal to xn minus 1, and apply the derivative to that again. Or there is an estimate that is called the least squares estimate of the second derivative, which is not causal. 2pn is 2yn minus 2 minus yn minus 1 minus 2yn, and then yn plus 1 and 2yn plus 2. So it is symmetrical on both sides of yn, subtracting the sample before and after, and adding 2 times the samples on either side, separated by 2 samples. So it is symmetric about the central point where the difference is being computed and given to the output. So this is non-causal. If you want to make it causal, you delay it by 2 samples. So shift everything by 2 samples. So this will become n minus 4, n minus 3, n minus 2, n minus 1, and that will be n. So you will introduce a delay of 2 samples. So depending upon whether you want causal implementation or not, you could take that step. The second derivative removes the effect of the downward slope on the carotid pulse, and on that you have the incisura. It enhances the notch. The result is squared and smooth like the other algorithms we have seen, because you could get positive and negative values, so you square it, and then there will be some noise, so you apply a filter, and you can write the filter in different ways. This is one way of writing the filter, where WK are the coefficients, and we used a linear weighting function, wk equal to m minus k plus 1. So the values just decrease as you go to the previous samples. And depending upon the sampling rate, you have to choose an appropriate window. And we chose 16 samples with sampling rate equal to 256 hertz. The particular analog to digital conversion board that we had had options for sampling rates like this in powers of 2. The interesting aspect of this is, now there is an upstroke and then there is a downward slope of the carotid pulse. So we get 2 peaks for each period of the carotid pulse. The first peak represents the onset of the carotid upstroke, where it increases as systole begins. And the second peak is due to the dichrotic notch. So to locate the dichrotic notch, we need to search for the local minimum in the carotid pulse corresponding to the second peak, and we expect that to be within a plus minus 20 millisecond interval with reference to the second peak that we get. So here's an example. It's a fairly clean and neat carotid pulse with a very clear dichrotic notch, the upstroke and the downslope, the upstroke and the downslope for 2 cardiac cycles. So So the smooth second derivative gives this output and then this. Now, from here, we also could possibly use the ECG as a trigger, but it's not necessary if you can identify which is the first peak. If you cannot do that reliably, then use the ECG, and then the peak in the carotid pulse after the peak corresponding to the QRS in the ECG, as we saw in the previous examples an hour ago, this would then be the first peak. The ECG QRS will be somewhere just before this. So after that, the second peak within the cardiac cycle is what we are interested in. So we detect the second peak and go to the carotid pulse. And here, what we want is the dicrotic notch, which is a local minimum. The global minimum is somewhere here, but we want a local minimum within a few milliseconds on either side of this peak. So that was the algorithm. So here, the signal was low-pass filtered to 100 hertz and sampled at 250 hertz. Why did I say 256 there? Just a minute, let me check that. Okay, we changed the sampling rate somewhere. We must have resampled it. So that is a method for the detection of the dichrotic notch. Now, once you detect the dichrotic notch, you can detect the second heart sound, and we will see the application of that later on. Okay. This is simply an extension of what we saw for the detection of the QRS complex, but the main difference is now we are using the second derivative or an approximation to the second derivative. Okay? It's a fairly simple problem. That was not the entire thesis of Rick Lehner. He did other analysis of the heart sound signal after detecting the dichrotic notch. So this was part of the thesis. Okay. Now let's move on to other applications, considering the EEG analysis. There are a few different applications in EEG analysis that I would like to present to you. First, let's consider the detection of EEG rhythms or identification of the presence of certain rhythms. The rhythms of interest are alpha, beta, theta, and delta that are in the bands that I showed from 0.5 hertz to 4 hertz and 4 to 8 and 8 to 12 or 13 and then 13 onwards. So all you have to do is detect the presence of rhythmic patterns or sinusoidal patterns that exist in these bands. And if there is significant energy in these bands, you can say the corresponding wave is present in that part of the EEG. But the EEG is a continuing signal that goes on, and the rhythms change depending upon the state of the subject. So you have to do this on a short time basis, taking windows of the signal. And then, depending upon the application, you have to choose an appropriate window duration. So in each window, you classify the rhythm present as alpha, beta, delta, and theta. One of the primary rhythms of interest is the alpha rhythm. So let's consider that. Propose a method to detect the presence of the alpha rhythm in an EEG channel. You could consider a few different approaches, and we will look at them. Now, and also another question is, how would you extend the method to detect the presence of the same rhythm in two channels simultaneously? So you would quite often be interested in knowing in a given channel what is the rhythm present, or if you want to know about alpha, is there alpha or not? And then you may also want to ask the question, if it is on the right side of a particular channel, what is on the left side, and do both of them have the same rhythm in common? Do both have alpha or not? So it is quite often of interest to know if the same rhythm is simultaneously present in two channels. So we go back to the question of comparing signals. A potential solution is two signals may be compared to detect common characteristics between them. We are their dot product. We will start by a simple formulation and work towards something else. The first point is, if you want to compare two signals or a signal with itself, you take a dot product by treating the signal samples as a vector. When you have two vectors, x and y, you know that when you take the dot product, you're projecting one vector onto the other, and the dot product indicates what is common between them. The magnitude is magnitude of x, magnitude of y, cosine of theta, and if theta is equal to 90 degrees, then there is nothing common between them, that is, they are orthogonal. If theta is 0, they are collinear, and you get the maximum projection. The basic definition is simply multiplication of x and y on a point-by-point basis and added over the duration of the signal n, 0 to n minus 1. So dot product is a projection of one signal onto the other, with each signal being viewed as an n-dimensional vector. N could be anything, any number of samples. Typically, we normalize the dot product so that we have a limited range. And that is normalized typically by the geometric mean of the energies of the two signals. So here you have sum of x squared n, sum of y squared n. This is the energy of x, this is the energy of y. And multiply them and take the square root, so this is the geometric mean, and divide the dot product by that quantity, and you get a value that is between plus and minus 1. If you don't want the means in the signal to affect the computation, you would subtract xn minus mu x and then yn minus mu y and do the same here. If the means have been removed, that is, there are already zero mean signals, you could ignore that step. In the case of continuous time signals, the projection is written as integral x dy t dt. So we'll call that theta xy. Now, if there is a shift between the events of interest in one signal corresponding to the other, then we have to account for that. So when a shift or time delay may be present in the occurrence of an epoch of interest, if you're comparing the entire signal and asking the question of what is common between them, you can do the dot product. But if you want to ask if a certain event is present in a channel and also in another channel, and if there is a delay between them, then you have to account for that. So if x has the event, which is this wave, and y has the same event, but here, if you just take the dot product, the result will be 0, and you will say there is nothing common between them, and obviously that will be wrong. So to check if there is something common between the two with a delay, you compute the cross-correlation function for all possible delays for which there is overlap between the two. So you take theta xy as a function of tau, that is a delay factor, and you shift one of the signals, keep one signal xt the same, the other yt plus tau, or t minus tau if you want to shift the opposite way, and then take the projection. When you shift, there is a question as to what you do when there is a non-overlapping part. If you shift this, what do you do here? You don't know of the signal before, and you assume that everything outside the interval that is provided to you is zero, which is not always correct, but that's the best you can do. So when you shift, you multiply only the overlapping part of the data that you have, which means you're assuming the data outside the interval for which you have the signal will be zero. Then you get the cross-correlation function as a function of the shift tau. Or you can write it in discrete format in this manner, where k is the shift applied to one of the signals, positive or negative, as you wish. The range of summation is limited to the range of available overlapping data between the two signals. And there could be a scale factor. You may have something here, 1 over something, 1 over the number of samples that overlap and enter the computation. That we can ignore. Now, in the case of random signals, we need to take the expectation operator or sample average of the outer product of the vectors. So let's assume that you have the data in vectorial format, xn, like this. Xn, this current sample, and n minus 1 past samples. And yn, vector, as yn and past samples up to yn minus n plus 1. And let these be n-dimensional vectorial forms of x and y with the most recent n samples as the signal is moving, or as your window of observation is moving. We did this with the Wiener filter. If x and y are sample observations of a random process, then their cross-correlation function is defined as the expectation of x, y transpose. And this is an outer product which will give you an n by n matrix. We saw this also with the case of the Wiener filter, but we had the autocorrelation matrix. Now we will have a cross-correlation matrix that has all possible pairs of x and y, samples of x and y appearing in an n by n matrix. And this provides cross terms for all possible delays between them for those n samples. So there are a few different formulations that you could apply. The autocorrelation function displays peaks at intervals corresponding to the period if the signal is periodic and its multiples. So if there is any periodic or repetitive pattern present in the signal, and this facilitates the detection of rhythms in signals such as the EEG. The alpha rhythm will be indicated by a peak near 0.1 second approximately, if it is 10 hertz. If it is 11 hertz, it will be a little less. The autocorrelation function of most signals will decay and reach negligible values after delays of a few milliseconds because the correlation between samples of the same signal separated by a large time delay will be very small. Nearby, the values are highly correlated in most real-life signals. Of course, if it is a completely random signal, the autocorrelation function will just be a delta function and the samples are mutually uncorrelated. Except for periodic signals of infinite or indefinite duration, where the autocorrelation function will also be periodic. The ACF, or autocorrelation function, will also exhibit multiple peaks when the same event repeats at regular or irregular intervals. So we'll see some examples a little later. The cross-correlation function, you're going to compare one signal with another. Here, the cross-correlation will display peaks at the period of any periodic pattern that is present in both signals. That should be common between the two of them. If there's nothing common between them, then the value will be low. The cross-correlation function may be used to detect rhythms that are present in both channels simultaneously. Rhythms that are common to both the signals, such as alpha rhythm in two EEG channels. When one of the functions is a template and you're comparing it with another signal, then cross-correlation is called template matching. So let's look at some examples here. We'll take something simpler. So suppose you have a periodic signal like this. The autocorrelation, you multiply the signal with itself and integrate and you get some value. And then you shift this. I'll just give, and in this schematic representation, when the shifted signal is multiplied with the original, the values will be smaller because they are out of sync. But for some other shift, there will be a time, and this is periodic, and there'll be one more for that period here somewhere. But there will come a time or a shift when the shifted version will align again. This will go there. This will go there. So these will align, and again you will have a large value and overlap. So the autocorrelation function will increase and decrease, and again increase and decrease because it is periodic, and so on. So from this, you can detect the period. Of course, here the period is obvious, but if you have a signal where the periodicity is not obvious, then the autocorrelation function will help you in detecting periodicity. Now, if you want to consider a different problem, where you want to detect the presence of a signal that you know to exist in the observed signal. There is a pattern that you suspect or know to exist in the observed signal, and you want to search where is that pattern present or how many times is it occurring. Then you can take this as a template. And then in the signal that you receive, there could be some occurrences, and they could be buried in a lot of noise. And you want to know where this pattern is occurring, then you bring this template, multiply the signal, taking projections of this onto the signal for the interval or duration of the template, and then you slide the template. So whenever the template matches an occurrence of the same pattern, you get a large value. When it matches or when it is overlaid with some background activity that is not similar to this pattern, the match will be low. The integral of the two or the projection of one onto the other will be low. So the cross-correlation result that is expected in template matching would be some low value, could be positive or negative, and then a large value, and then some small values and a large value. And suppose it is reflected here, you could get some values and a large value, and some values and a large negative value. In this manner, you can detect multiple presence of the same pattern in the received signal or the observed signal. This is quite common in radar and sonar, where you have a pulse of known shape and you transmit it, and then you turn your transducer, the sending transducer, into a receiving mode and listen for echoes from other objects. The echo that is received will carry this signature or a version of this pulse that you sent out, the waveform that you sent out, buried in noise, and wherever there is a reflection due to some other object, you will get this pattern back, not like this, but you will typically get these with smaller amplitudes, and the noise will be small, let us say, and these amplitudes will be smaller, and this could be smaller. So then these peaks will be proportionately smaller peaks. So now the problem is detecting the peaks in the result of template matching and identifying the presence of that template. And because you transmitted that pulse, you know the shape and you can do the cross-correlation. So cross-correlation is useful to in recognizing patterns of known characteristics. It's also done in image processing for, let's say, optical character recognition. If you want to look for the letter R, you have a template of the R and you run it across the whole image, pixel by pixel, moving pixel by pixel, and whenever it sits, your template sits on a similar pattern, you will get a large output value. There could be some errors caused because this the R could match something else. I don't know what else is there. When your template sits on N, this much of N looks like R, so template matching may fail in some cases, may give you large values for some patterns that are obviously different to us, but for on a pixel by pixel basis, may match quite well. So in the case of a signal also, there could be situations where some spurious patterns could give you high correlation. So you will need additional logic to reject those. So here is an example of the autocorrelation function. And here I cut out parts of the EEG signal from figure 1.22. Now that's in a different file, so I won't go back there. I showed you the EEG signal with alpha rhythm. I took a part of that signal from 4.67 to 5.81 seconds. I took a fairly short segment. I didn't do this for the entire signal. And then did autocorrelation, and this is the result, where clearly you see a second peak at about 0.1 second. And that corresponds to 10 hertz. So there is periodicity in this signal, or the signal segment I chose, with a period of 0.1 second or 10 hertz, which is alpha. Now, because it is periodic, there will be peaks at multiples of this. It's not exactly 0.1, it must be 0.11 or something, so it is 2.2 and 3.3, and approximately so. Note also that it is decaying. If it is a perfectly periodic sinusoidal or cosinusoidal wave, then the autocorrelation will also be perfectly periodic and each of the peaks will be equal to 1. But here, it is not a perfect sinusoid. It varies in amplitude. So this is not completely periodic, but there are repeated peaks at approximately integral multiples of the time instant of the first peak. So that indicates a rhythmic pattern that is present in the signal, which in this case is alpha. So just to repeat what I said earlier, in the case of the autocorrelation function, if the signal is periodic, the autocorrelation function is also periodic. If it is completely random, this is a delta function, delta t, delta n, whatever. So the autocorrelation function of a completely random signal is just an impulse. And of course, the Fourier transform of that is a constant, which is white noise. If it is some general, I don't know what to say, some signal, then typically these values will decay fairly rapidly in most cases. In general, you expect the autocorrelation to decay, which means the signal is a low-pass signal. Okay, I'll come back to this part later on, the lower part. Here I took a segment from 4.2 to 4.9 seconds in one of those channels where there is no alpha and just some background signal which I assume is noise, and the autocorrelation function is a decaying function. There is no second peak. This is not a peak. This is very small. What is happening here? Okay. And you don't see any repeated peaks. So there is no periodicity in this case. And if you refer to this part of the channel that is identified in figure 1.22, you will see that it is just noise. So this is a decaying autocorrelation function. Here is an example of a cross-correlation function between two segments from P3 and P4 channels in the interval 4.7 to 5.7 seconds. So I'm comparing one channel with another channel, and both of them in this case have alpha, if you refer to that figure 1.22. And clearly, we have peaks again at about 0.11 and multiples 0.2233 and 4.4. So the period of this pattern is 0.11, which is approximately 9 hertz, which is also alpha. Here we have the cross-correlation between two other channels, the O2 channel and the C4 channel, and there is some rhythmic pattern coming here, but the values are lower. So there is a little bit in common between them, but not much. And I think there's one more. Yeah, between F3 and F4 channels, and here you don't see the periodicity or the presence of peaks in the cross-correlation. So there is nothing common between these two. Yeah, let me go back here now and show something else. I mentioned earlier that the Fourier transform of the autocorrelation function is the power spectral density function. So here in the lower part of each plot, we have the Fourier transform of what is above, shown in dB and the frequency axis here. Sometimes interpretation of the autocorrelation or cross-correlation function could be a little difficult. When there are multiple peaks here, one may not find it easy to interpret the results. If you are asking for the question you are asking is regarding the presence of energy in a certain band of frequencies, then it is not obvious directly. Of course, as engineers, we can figure it out. But to somebody who is not trained in this area and cannot interpret this, there could be some difficulty in understanding the presence of multiple peaks and measuring the intervals and interpreting that as a rhythm. Whereas if you take the Fourier transform, very clearly, there is a large peak near 10 hertz, about 9 hertz. There is significant energy in this band. I normalize so that the maximum is at 1 or 0 dB. And the peak is clearly there. And outside this band, there isn't much energy. Most of the energy is between 8 and 11 hertz, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 hertz. So that's the bandwidth of the signal. So that is clearly alpha. In this case, the power spectral density, this is the autocorrelation of a portion where there is no alpha and essentially no activity. It's just background noise, perhaps, or there is something that is not alpha. And the power spectral density shows that there is no peak beyond the very low frequency region of 1 or 2 hertz. Of course, there is no DC. The DC has been removed here. But that is not obvious in the spectrum here. There is no energy in the band around 10 hertz, no significant peak. So it is easier to interpret the power spectral density than the autocorrelation or cross-correlation in some cases. This is the cross-correlation, and this is the Fourier transform, which is the cross-spectral density. The cross-spectral density will show a peak in the region where both signals have common energy. And that, in this case, again, is in the alpha range with a peak at about 9 hertz and almost nothing outside. Now, these look like peaks, but those are just the effects of noise and variance in the estimation of the spectral density because I'm just using two signals. If you were to average this over multiple observations, these variations will go away. So we're not to consider these. In the case of the cross-correlation where the overlap is small, although the cross-correlation function shows peaks, the Fourier transform does not show any significant energy in any particular band. So the values here are 0.8 and below, or 0.85 and below, and they are not significant. It's a bit difficult to interpret that because the values are not very high but not very low. The cross-spectral density shows that this level here is fairly low, below minus 10 dB, so it is not significant. So there is no common rhythm, no significant common rhythm present between O2 and C4 in this case. In the last case, there are no peaks there and there are no clear peaks here. But again, because this is a spectral density computed from only two signal segments, fairly short segments, there will be such variations, and we need to take care in not interpreting these as peaks in the spectrum. These are just the effects of limited data and the fact that we are computing this function from only two signals. Okay? Any questions on the autocorrelation or cross-correlation or